So I will continue with presenting results from this study. And the authors are the same. And again, certainly want to thank CDC for funding this effort through the Colorado Injury Control, CIC, Colorado Injury Control and Research Center. And my aim, after we've heard about the unadjusted, unweighted results, is to describe the methodology for weighting, to try to get this to be a more representative sample of the Colorado population, talk a bit about how we went about controlling for demographics and place of injury when we evaluated TBI data, and provide you with some adjusted and weighted prevalence estimates, prevalence ratios of disability after TBI, and discuss a few of the limitations and implications. Jeff has described the background of this study, random digit dial, 2,700 people, collected a lot of information, demographics, the modified OSU TBI ID CADI, and a whole range of outcome measures, and the prevalence of disability appears to follow a gradient of injury from no injury to severe injuries. Saw that in the last set of slides. We wanted to weight the data to the Colorado population, and we used a method called raking, one of the most recent and sophisticated approaches to the weighting process. It's an iterative proportional weighting algorithm that matches individual characteristics of each case to the population. It runs iteratively. It, luckily, in this case, it converges, and when you're done, you end up with parameter estimates of the sample that match the population. Used pretty much all of the available demographic variables in that raking process, so it literally includes all of the variables on this list, all the standard demographic variables. And then there's a process of weight trimming, which attempts to test whether the most extreme weights, if they are reduced down to the 5th and 95th percentile, whether that improves the distribution of your outcomes. In this case, it didn't, so we didn't proceed with that approach. In terms of trying to control for all of the demographic characteristics and place of care, we used a modified Poisson regression that yields prevalence ratios or relative risks, as opposed to logistic regression, which yields odds ratios, which have been shown to overestimate prevalence ratios. I say that as if everyone in the audience should know that that's the beauty of Poisson regression, but in reality, Dr. Cuthbert told me that's what we should do, and it's really great to have a young person around who recently got their doctorate. They just know so much more. It makes me feel old, but I'm at least free range. So here, trouble with balance, the prevalence ratios. These are the numbers that Jeff provided earlier. So in terms of having a problem with balance at the time of the interview, people that reported severe TBI were 4.8 times more likely than the no injury group to report that trouble with balance. And you see the nice stair step, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, when you now adjust for all of the demographics and then add in the place of care, whether they were admitted to the hospital, emergency department, physician's office, or no treatment, here we see that now we've got everything in the equation except the TBI, and the folks that were admitted to the hospital for whatever their injury, those folks had a 1.7 times greater likelihood of reporting trouble with balance than the group that was was reporting no treatment. When you add in, then, finally, all of the variables, including the TBI, the effect of being admitted to the hospital actually goes away, and now you have the stair step of now severe TBI after controlling for all of the demographics and the place of care. Those who reported severe TBI 5.5 times more likely to also tell you that they currently had trouble with balance or equilibrium than the folks with no injury. And so, again, a nice gradient or stair step, 5.5 for severe, 4.4 for moderate, 2.2 for mild. Now, the 1.6 for the no injury, for the injury but no TBI group, that was not statistically different from the no injury group. When you move to the memory, and I'll be reporting the same six variables that you saw previously, and the first slide in each case matches the data from the slide that you saw in the earlier presentation. The nice stair step here for problems with memory, severe TBI 3.5 times more likely than no injury, moderate 2.5, 1.7 for mild, 1.3 for the injury, no TBI. Here, when you control for all the demographics and add in the place of care, you now see that not only admitted to the hospital being statistically significant compared to the no treatment group, also the folks treated in the emergency department or a physician's office or clinic, also significantly different from the no injury group. But when you include all of the variables, including the TBI severity indicator, the actually the place of treatment is no longer significant, and you see a nice stair step, 4-3-2-1, for the prevalence ratios of severe, moderate, mild, and injury no TBI compared to no injury. In the poor satisfaction with life, here's the, again, nice stair step, essentially 4-3-2-1 times more likely for the greater severity of TBI. In this case, there was, when you consider all the demographics and then add in the place of care, no significant differences there, nor was place of care significant when TBI was added back in. But again, you see the nice gradient, 4.7 for severe, 3.1 for moderate, 2.3 for mild, 1.9 for injury, no TBI, all significantly different than the no injury group. Work limitation, starting again with the stair step 3.6, 2.3, 1.9, 1.4. Here, all of the places of care were including admitted to the hospital, emergency department, or physician's office. In terms of work limitation, that was two times higher for all of those compared to the no treatment group. And when you added in the TBI, the place of care remained significant in predicting work limitation, and there was a decline in the stair step, but still severe TBI more than twice as likely than the no injury group to be reporting work limitations. Moderate significant 1.8, mild significant 1.6, no difference between the injury no TBI and the no injury group. The greater than one day poor mental health per month, here's the prevalence ratio. The severe, moderate, and mild TBIs significantly different than the no injury, but not a dramatic stair step approach. When you control for demographics and add in place of care, for some reason, the emergency department is what comes out as significantly different there, but that goes away when you include the TBI variable, and in this case, you're left with severe TBI being significantly different than no injury after controlling for all of the other variables at nearly twice the prevalence rate and the no injury group for poor mental health. And when you move to poor physical health, the not quite stair step that was seen before, the place of care is not a significant predictor, and it is not a significant predictor when everything is added in. But again, now there's a drop in the controlling for everything else. The prevalence ratio for the severe TBI group drops from 3.5 to 2.2. And that and the mild group are statistically significantly different from the no injury group. And just to say a few words about the regression models to summarize particularly the demographic variables, because I didn't show you any of the results for the demographic variables. When you start with the demographic variables for these particular outcomes, only a minority of the demographic variables are significant predictors of outcomes when TBI is not included. Once you include the place of care and the TBI, now actually there's a majority of the demographic variables are predictive of outcome, potentially indicating that there are demographic factors that are predictive of receiving a TBI. Place of care was only significant in predicting work limitation in the final model, and place of care was not significant with the other five outcomes reported. But the main point here is that when controlling for demographics and place of care, severe TBI was a significant predictor of all of the negative outcomes, or to say it in other words, disability. And all severities of TBI were significant predictors in most of the outcomes, with, in most of the cases, that clear gradient of more severe TBI associated with greater prevalence of those of disability. And note that the injury no TBI group was significant compared to the no injury group for just memory and life satisfaction. Point out a few limitations. While Jeff has made the case that this is a reliable data that was collected, it has not been clinically validated. And while taking the advice of Dr. Cuthbert, we attempted to use the most sophisticated methods for weighting and assessing. We remain any of the inherent biases in the BRFSS methodology would be corrected as much as possible, but still be there. And only six of the many potential outcomes that we reported today, and all I can say is trust me. In a political campaign sense, and that these were representative of other outcomes that we could have shown you. And so the overall conclusions here, weighted to the population of Colorado, the lifetime history of TBI is higher than has been reported in other studies and other populations. We're reporting a weighted rate of any TBI during the lifetime at 42.5%, and that is higher, and about the only comparable study is the birth cohort of Christchurch in New Zealand, which is a clinical study, and they're coming up with very high TBI rates as well, so we don't think we're necessarily way off base. We think that we're doing a better job of asking questions in a way that elicits memory of TBI. The occurrence of TBI and its severity are predictors of negative outcomes. The minority of people reporting TBI were treated in the hospital, and which is the typical source of the studies that talk about disability after TBI. And the implications, I think, are that this methodology could be applied nationally, and if a national study replicated similar findings that we have here, it would substantially increase our current estimates of the number of people, the prevalence of TBI, and it would certainly increase the estimates of the number of people living with disability after a TBI. Thank you.
Fantastic presentations. As an MPH student in epidemiology, I found everybody's presentation very great. So now we're going to open it up for discussion and questions. So I will come around and bring the microphone.
In the ranking process, the higher rate of females over males comes back into line, so that after weighting, the ratio of male to female is proportional to the Colorado population in 2010.
Okay.
Yeah, there were greater percentage of females than males.
And yes, we did have age, and it was, we were looking at an older population. Our 18 to 20 population is extremely small, and that group got upweighted significantly. Remember, these are interviews that are going out, random digit dial. They're not necessarily going to cell phones at this point. At least that was the methodology we had available to us at that point.
And bottom line, the percent of people reporting TBI in their lifetime, raw data was at 38%, weighted data after raking
42.5. This is the last question. No, sorry. I wonder if you thought about looking at the data across different disability subgroups. I know you use the variable for England, but it strikes me that, for example, someone with a cognitive limitation is never going to be considered, who answers yes twice on the cognitive question, is never going to be considered to have a temporary disability, even if they have a temporary disability on top of their cognitive limitation. I've looked at the math data for different subsets of disability, and there are reported differences that come up. So I wonder if there's a, if you thought about looking at it that way and kind of keeping out maybe what those differences are, or looking at just understanding who that population is a little more closely, because it may be that it's all people with physical disabilities, even if there's
correct. That's everything she said. Write that down. we basically talked our way through all of this, and we recognize that the degree to which we are measuring disability is, it's higher than the 3,000-foot level. It's like those photos of Hurricane Sandy. Unfortunately, to get in any way deeper would have taken money that we didn't have, and that you would have to get up to the research data center to use the MEPS and then maybe tie it back to, for those of you who don't know, MEPS is a subsample of the National Health Interview Survey. So it is possible that if we had money, or if someone wishes to do that and has money, that you could go find out a great deal more about what is the diagnoses associated with the disability, then go flip over to MEPS and go explore the cost. We recognize that that would have been a better thing to do, but this was, as I mentioned, an unfunded doctoral research. So everything she said is important, and if you get money and want to do this, do it that way. Dr. Arun has something to say as well.
One of the things within the MAPS that there is a limited information available. There's still limited information available on conditions. So if you are aware with the MAPS, you go to the conditions file. And within the conditions file, there is a possibility that you can classify the ICD-9 codes into clinical classifications and examine that. So if so just for your information, that it is possible for you to be able to at least get a systems-level classification of specific conditions. But I definitely agree that you definitely need to have an access to the AHRQ data center to really get to the level of ICD and diagnosis for doing more hair splitting, if I may say so, in terms of the diagnosis.
I just wanted to ask you another question about your Cornell data set. I guess I didn't realize the extent of it and the number of data sets that are included. So your data set, that you, their stats ready or a spreadsheet ready, importable data sets that people can access, or it's an opportunity to learn about the data sets. I guess I couldn't tell from your presentation how deep it went.
Well, it's I would say it's more of an opportunity for people to learn about the data sets. So we are not making any specific data set available in SAS or any other exportable format. But what we are providing is listing of variables and helping researchers view through those different questions in a more easier fashion than spending day and night of looking into 800 pages code book of MAPS or several thousand pages of any other code book. So that's the idea.
What you're saying as well is that we can actually see the question for the variable?
Yes, and unfortunately, as I said, if I had access to the internet, I would have been able to show those specific variables and questions and then showed how we can download that into an Excel spreadsheet for across survey comparisons.
As a volunteer for this session, I apologize for the convenience or lack of access to the internet. But we didn't have maybe up to more than 500 members, maybe we can afford that. So I that session. So for that's a good reason to join. Anyway, I have a couple of questions on the so. First, you mentioned your data set includes six data sets. So could you, my first question is to repeat these six again, capture and answer, that is powerful. My second question is your website has the capacity to crosswalk changes of the questions across different years? So for a lot of people that did talk earlier this morning, this question too, that lack of your sample size, okay, most of the times people combine multiple years of data. When we try to do that, always the problem is how the question being placed, or if this question appears in this year, that drops next year, but it's coming up 2 years after, or something like that. Actually, I do know. Nowadays, that I appreciate your type of work and the big data very accessible. I do remember when I started writing it, I used the time chart for SPSS. Instead, it was a table line to ask for hours of numbering, finally, the table made to download the data. Now everything is pretty handy from the desktop, you know, to do that. Not only a federal or other agency I have seen has provided the type of services you just described, like ICPS, University Consortium, other companies, much more than six services, or Barclays, even the CDC's Cyber Defense Program, because the data sets on the phone banks, all the steps, specifically the Barclays. And I was aware that American Community Surveys, we have a population data set CDAS user, now we have a whole lot of options. And what is the status point of your site compared to other sites?
Sure. So maybe I'll answer your last question first, and then talk about the others. The last question is that what's our sales point? The sales point is there is a specific focus on disability and health issues that the other websites and the other service providers do not provide. And the fact that we have a deeper understanding of disability-specific definition, the way we have split those disability classifications will provide users an understanding of different available variables, and they can make an informed choice based on the framework of disability that they are using in their research to be able to utilize those specific variables in their work. So that's the only sales pitch I have for our website. So currently we have six data sets for which we have cross-variable catalog. First is the health and retirement study, health and retirement survey. Then we have the National Health Interviews survey data. We have information of Medical Expenditure Panel survey. We have information on the National Health Nutrition and Examination survey. We have information on National Long-Term Care survey. We have information on National Survey of Children's Health. So these are different surveys where we've been able to catalog all their variables and provide that in that interactive environment. And then your second question was?
Change the question.
Yes. So, sure. So I should also mention that this was a very laborious and a grueling process. In fact, working with Amol, myself, and working with Bill Erickson, who's like our ringmaster in this whole work, it took us hours and hours with two graduate students to be able to catalog this. So at this point in time, our focus has been in terms of cataloging the most recent available versions of the survey. Provided funding, there is a possibility for us to be able to do that. So we do all the splitting of the variables and coding of those variables using Excel spreadsheets, and then we upload that into the SQL Server database, and then provide this through the ColdFusion front page where you can open, expand, do all the capacities. So it's a multi-step process. It's very manual. It's not automatized because we have lots of decision algorithms that we put into place to classify and codify, but provided additional resources and interest and funding, we definitely may be able to go to that extent where we can provide changes across different years for the other surveys.
Take a stab at that. I think simply learning that the population that is out there with disability following TBI is, I think, larger than has been reported, and even what's being reported by CDC currently is large. I think that draws a policy attention to the group, and you can argue, well, maybe not everything is due to the TBI and all the negative outcomes we're seeing, but we are able to compare that with the no injury or the injury but no TBI group. So I think it'll provide information to emphasize the importance of TBI as a policy area. This study doesn't give us insight into what specific treatment approaches make any sense, but it does give us a sense about which of the range of outcomes, negative outcomes, are most prevalent, and therefore gives you some idea of how to begin. Not a good answer. We haven't, you know, we need to work with this more and talk with our clinicians about how they can help translate, and the whole knowledge translation area is a difficult one. That's another area that I have limited expertise.
I'm sorry if I missed it, but is the paper in publication progressing?
No, but we're writing.
Yes.
And we have three papers planned.
I'm Meg Tracy with the Montana Disability and Health Program, and I just want to know how much do we owe you for the data set? But I'm trying to think how I can engage students without having to sit down one-on-one with each, and I'm wondering if you have some kind of interactive guide where students are asked questions and then they use the tool to discover the facility of it for learning more about data sets. If you have that, we'd love to get it out to our public health students. And then my question is about the METS data, whether or not there was a difference in dropout from the persistent disability group versus
I'll take the easy one. Everyone's arranging thoughts. The easy answer is we did not examine that, and I've just made a note of it.
In terms of an interactive guide, right now, we possibly may be able to put together a presentation webinar, and we've yet to finalize on what that might be. But if one were to be able to visit the website that we shared, I think it's just totally point and click, and we can get to a point where students really learn themselves, learn with playing around with the website, for the lack of a better word. But if you just poke around the website, and you'll get the answers that you need. So it's pretty self-explanatory in several ways. But we can definitely look into preparing and hosting webinars. And I don't know, Amol, did you have anything to add for that? And Amol is our partner at UTMB, and they are the lead on the data set projects, and this is the part that we do at EDI.
So one of the other features that we have on the website is the technical assistance. So anyone who is interested in learning more about the data sets, what's in there, they can simply register, and then the question you put here, they can start the question and record specific question. And it comes to Billerix and Parnell and myself, and then we try to find the answer. And actually, have to talk to other people who are actually using that data for this. And the data that we have included are the ones that either we are working on it. Other people that are working on it, some of our partner institutions. So we have like a Facebook using some of those. But the technical assistance would be a good resource for us. And we get like 5-6 queries in the months, more about what the variables are available. And if this is our question, it could be appropriate data set.
And this is more out of curiosity, I think, than anything, but with sort of the recent emphasis on sports-related injuries, particularly football, I was wondering if anybody's putting any longitudinal study with brain injuries in football, you know, where they're unconscious or whatever happens with them over time, you know, from high school, college, pros.
university actually enrolls all of their football players and all of their rugby players as the day they hit campus, and they do baseline testing of them. They do neuropsych testing, they do balance testing, and they do vision testing, and they actually follow them through the 4 years. As far as beneath the collegiate level and then into the pro level, I know a large piece of money was just put available by the NFL to follow and to do outcomes with TBI incurred at the pro level. And Lisa, I don't know, do you mind? I know CDC has an initiative with football as well.
Yeah, thank you. There's a project at Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, by my mom, Comstock. She had a national representative sample for 9 sports, and this is data in high school that are supported by athletic training. So it all includes data for the national representative for those 9 sports, and also includes the rest of the NCAA sports. The interesting thing about Don's data is that it has information about the actual injury of the event. We're planning a small part of the project and link to the actual medical records. So with Don's data, we're able to see how much what happened to the kid before the injury, after the injury, how much school were they in, how it's affecting their education. The NCAA does have a similar project in place as well, where they just had a recent TBI meeting and they were there, and they are really a model. I mean, the type of screening system, NCAA athletes, the type of care, and if they put it, if an NCAA athlete is affected in saying any type of sport related or practice related concussion, they will seek care or have care provided to them. That's not the case for others. Now, one message I have in my soapbox here is, please remember, yes, concussion sports are getting a lot of media attention, but that's only 20% of the traumatic brain injuries we see in the U.S. So, yes, I will thank the sports folks for getting the attention of traumatic brain injury needs, but just remember, everybody is out there for traumatic brain injury and does not take up the level. Okay, so we're going to wrap up. Thank you very much for joining us.